The hound shook its head, still growling horribly. Then it suddenly screamed, a shockingly human sound. Its eyes grew wide in terror. Then it began desperately to snap at the empty air around it, whimpering and trying to cringe back. As suddenly as it had attacked, it turned and fled, howling, back down into the undergrowth. "What did you do?" Silk demanded. A faint smile touched Sadi's slender features.
"When ancient Belgarath told me about Torak's hounds, I took certain precautions," he replied, his head slightly cocked as he listened to the terrified yelps of the huge dog receding off into the distance.
"Poison?"
"No. It's really rather contemptible to poison a dog if you don't have to. The hound simply inhaled some of that powder I threw into its face. It began to see some very distracting things. Very distracting." He smiled again. "Once I saw a cow accidentally sniff the flower that the main ingredient of the powder comes from. The last time I saw her, she was trying to climb a tree." He looked over at Belgarath. "I hope you didn't mind my taking action without consulting you, Ancient One. But as you have pointed out, your sorcery might alert others in the region, and I had to move quickly to deal with the situation before you felt compelled to unleash it anyway."
"That's quite all right, Sadi," Belgarath replied. "I may have said it before, but you are a very versatile little fellow."
"Merely a student of pharmacology, Belgarath. I have found that there are chemicals suitable for almost every situation."
"Won't the hound report back to its pack that we are here?"
Turnick asked, looking around worriedly.
"Not for several days," Zadi chuckled, brushing off his hands and holding them as far away from his face as possible.
They rode slowly up the weed-grown track along the bottom of the ravine where mournful blackened trees spread their branches, filling the deep cut with a pervading gloom. Off in the distance they could hear the baying of Torak's hounds as they coursed through the forest. Above them, sooty ravens flapped from limb to limb, croaking hungrily.
"Disquieting sort of place," Velvet murmured.
"And that adds the perfect touch," Silk noted, pointing at a large vulture perched on the limb of a dead snag at the head of the ravine.
"Are we close enough to Ashaba yet for you to be able to tell if Zandramas is still there?" Geryon asked Polgara.
"Possibly," she replied.
"But even that fainter sound could be heard."
"We are close enough now that we can wait," Belgarath said. "I will tell you one thing, though. If my great-grandson is at Ashaba, I will take the place apart stone by stone until I find him, and I don't care how much noise it makes."
Impulsively, Zenedra pulled her horse in beside his, leaned over and locked her arms about his waist.
"Oh, Belgarath," she said, "I love you."
And she burrowed her face into his shoulder.
"What's this?"
His voice was slightly surprised. She pulled back, her eyes misty. She wiped at them with the back of her hand, and then gave him an arch look.
"You are the dearest man in all the world," she told him. "I might even consider throwing Geryon over for you, if it weren't for the fact that you're 12,000 years old, that is."
7, he corrected automatically.
She gave him a sadly whimsical smile, a melancholy sign of her final victory in an ongoing contest that no longer had any meaning for her.
Whatever,
she sighed, and then, in a peculiarly uncharacteristic gesture, he enfolded her in his arms and gently kissed her.
"My dear child," he said with brimming eyes.
And then he looked back over his shoulder at Polgara.
"How did we ever get along without her?"
Polgara's eyes were a mystery.
"I don't know, father," she replied. "I really don't."
At the head of the ravine, Sadi dismounted and dusted the leaves of a low bush growing in the middle of the track they were following with some more of his powder.
"Just to be on the safe side," he explained,
pulling himself back into the saddle. The region they entered under a lowering sky was a wooded plateau. They rode on along the scarcely visible track in a generally northerly direction, with the rising wind whipping at their cloaks. The baying of Torak's hounds still sounded from some distance off, but seemed to be coming no closer. As before, Silk and Feldegast ranged out ahead, scouting for possible danger. Geryon again rode at the head of their column, his helmet in place and the butt of his lance riding in his stirrup. As he rounded a sharp bend in the track, he saw Silk and the juggler ahead. They had dismounted and were crouched behind some bushes. Silk turned quickly and motioned Geryon back. Geryon quickly passed on the signal and, step by step, backed his gray stallion around the bend again. He dismounted, leaned his lance against a tree, and took off his helmet. "What is it?" Belgareth asked, also swinging down from his horse.
"I don't know," Geryon replied. "Silk motioned us to stay out of sight."
"Let's go have a look," the old man said.
"Right."
The two of them crouched over and moved forward on silent feet to join the rat-faced man and the juggler. Silk put his fingers to his lips as they approached. When Geryon reached the brush, he carefully parted the leaves and looked out. There was a road there, a road that intersected the track that they had been following. Riding along that road were half a hundred men dressed mostly in furs, rusty helmets on their heads and bent and dented swords in their hands. The men at the head of the column, however, wore mail coats. Their helmets were polished, and they carried lances and shields. Tensely, without speaking, Geryon and his friends watched the loosely organized mob ride past. When the strangers were out of sight, Feldegast turned to Belgareth.
"It sort of confirms your suspicion, old friend."
"Who were they?"
Geryon asked in a low voice.
"The ones in fur be Kerans," Feldegast replied, "and the ones in steel be Temple Guardsmen. 'Tis more evidence of an alliance between Irvon and Menga, you see."
"Can we be sure that the Kerans were Menga's men?"
"He's overcome Katakor altogether, and the only armed Kerans in the area be his. Irvon and his kingdom control the guardsmen and the hounds. When you see Kerans and hounds together, the way we did yesterday, 'tis fair proof of an alliance. But when you see Kerandese fanatics escorted by armed guardsmen, it doesn't leave hardly any doubt at all."
"What is that fool up to?"
Belgareth muttered.
"Who?"
Silk asked.
"Irvon. He's done some fairly filthy things in his life, but he has never consorted with demons before."
"Perhaps 'twas Torak had forbid it," Feldegast suggested. "Now that Torak's dead, though, maybe he's thrown off all restraints. The demons would be a powerful factor if the final confrontation between the Church and the Imperial Throne that's been brewing all these years should finally come."
"Well," Belgareth grunted, "we don't have time to sort it out now. Let's get the others and move on."
They quickly crossed the road that the Kerans and the guardsmen had been following and continued along the narrow track. After a few more miles, they crested a low knoll that at some time in the past had been denuded by fire. At the far end of that plateau, just before a series of stark cliffs rising sharply into the mountains, there stood a huge black building, rearing up almost like a mountain itself. It was surmounted by bleak towers and surrounded by a battlement-topped wall, half-smothered in vegetation.
"Ashaba," Belgareth said shortly, his eyes flinty.
"I thought it was a ruin,"
Silk said with some surprise.
"Parts of it are, I have been told," the old man replied. "The upper floors are not habitable anymore. But the ground floor is still more or less intact. At least, it's supposed to be. It takes a very long time for wind and weather to tear down a house that big."
The old man nudged his horse and led them down off of the knoll, back into the wind-tossed forest. It was nearly dark by the time they reached the edge of the clearing surrounding the house of Torak. Geryon noted that the vegetation half covering the walls of the black castle consisted of brambles and thick-stemmed ivy. The glazing in the windows had long since succumbed to wind and weather, and the vacant casements seemed to stare out at the clearing like the eye sockets of a dark skull.
"Well, father," Bulgara said.
He scratched at his beard, listening to the baying of the hounds back in the forest.
"Even you're open to a bit of advice, me ancient friend," Feldegast said. "Wouldn't it be wiser to wait until dark before we go in? Should there be watchers in the house, the night will conceal us from their eyes. And then, too, once it grows dark, there will undoubtedly be lights inside if the house be occupied. 'Twill give us some idea of what to expect."
"It makes sense, Belgarath," Silk agreed. "Walking openly up to an unfriendly house in broad daylight disturbs my sense of propriety."
"That is because you have got the soul of a burglar. But it is probably the best plan, anyhow. Let's pull back into the woods a ways and wait for dark."
Though the weather had been warm and spring-like on the plains of Rakuth and Vena, here in the foothills of the Kerendiz Mountains there was still a pervading chill, for winter only reluctantly released its grip on these highlands. The wind was raw, and there were some places back under the trees where dirty windrows of last winter's snow lay deep and unyielding.
"Is that wall around the house going to cause us any problems?"
Geryon asked.
"Not unless someone has repaired the gates," Belgarath replied. "When Belden and I came in here after Vomimbre, they were all locked, so we had to break them down to get in."
"Walking openly up to them gates might not be the best idea in the world, Belgarath. For if the house do be occupied by Candom or Kerens or guardsmen, 'tis certain that the gates are going to be watched, and there be a certain amount of light even on the darkest night. There be a sally port on the east side of the house, though, and it gives entry into an inner court that for sure is to be filled with deep shadow as soon as the night comes on."
"Won't it be barred off?" Silk asked him.
"Oh, to be sure, Prince Keldar, it was indeed. The lock, however, was not difficult for a man with fingers as nimble as mine."
"You have been inside, then?"
"I like to poke around in abandoned houses from time to time. One never knows what the former inhabitants might have left behind, and finding is oftentimes as good as earning or stealing."
"Oh, I can accept that," Silk replied. Durnick came back from the edge of the woods where he had been watching the house. He had a slightly worried look on his face.
"Well, I'm not entirely positive, but it looks as if there are clouds of smoke coming out of the towers of that place."
"I'll just go along with you and have a bit of a look," the juggler said.
And he and the smith went back through the deepening shadows beneath the trees. After a few minutes they came back. Dornick's expression was faintly disgusted.
"Smoke?" Belgarath asked.
Feldegast shook his head.
"Bats," he replied. "Thousands of the little beasties. They be coming out of the towers in great black clouds."
"Bats?"
Tindedra exclaimed, her hands going instinctively to her hair. "It's not uncommon," Bulgara told her. "Bats need protected places to nest in, and a ruin, or an abandoned place, is almost ideal for them."
"But they are so ugly,"
Tindedra declared with a shudder.
"'Tis only a flying mouse, me little darling," Feldegast told her.
"I'm not fond of mice, either."
"'Tis a very unforgiving woman you've married, young master," Feldegast said to Geryon. "Brim full of prejudices and unreasonable dislikes."
"More important, did you see any lights coming from inside?"
"Not so much as a glimmer, ancient one. But the house be large, and there be chambers inside which have no windows. Torek was unfond of the sun, as you will recall."
"Let's move around through the woods, until we are closer to this sally port of yours," the old man suggested, "before the light goes entirely."
They stayed back from the edge of the trees as they circled around the clearing, with the great black house at its center. The last light was beginning to fade from the cloud-covered sky as they cautiously peered out from the edge of the woods.
"I can't quite make out that sallyport," Silk murmured, peering toward the house.
"That is partially concealed," Feldegast told him. "If you give ivy the least bit of a toehold, it can engulf a whole building in a few hundred years. Quiet your fears, Prince Skeldar. I know me way, and I can find the entrance to the house of Torak
on the blackest of nights.
The hounds are likely to be patrolling the area around here after dark, aren't they? Geryon said. He looked at Tzadi. I hope you didn't use up all of your powder back there.
There's more than enough left, Belgerion, the eunuch smiled, patting his pouch. A light dusting at the entrance to Master Feldegast's sallyport should ensure that we won't be disturbed once we are inside.
What do you think? Durnick asked, squinting up at the dark sky.
It's close enough, Belgareth grunted. I want to get inside.
They led their horses across the weed-choked clearing until they reached the looming wall.
"'Tis this way just a bit,' Feldegast said in a low voice as he began to feel his way along the rough black stones of the wall.
They followed him for several minutes, guided more by the faint rustling sound of his feet among the weeds than by sight.
"'Ah, and here we are now,' Feldegast said, with some satisfaction.
It was a low, arched entrance in the wall, almost totally smothered in ivy and brambles. Durnick and the giant Toth, moving slowly to avoid making too much noise, pulled the obstructing vines aside to allow the rest of them and the horses to enter. Then they followed, pulling the vines back in place once again to conceal the entrance. Once they were inside, it was totally dark, and there was the musty smell of mildew and fungus.
"'May I borrow your flint and steel and tinder again, Goodman Durnick?' Feldegast whispered.
Then there was a small clinking sound, followed by a rapid clicking accompanied by showers of glowing sparks, as Feldegast, kneeling so that his body concealed even those faint glimmers, worked with Durnick's flint and steel. After a moment, he blew on the tinder, stirring a tiny flame into life. There was another clink as he opened the front of a square lantern he had taken from a small niche in the wall.
"'Is that altogether wise?'
Durnick asked doubtfully, as the juggler lighted the candle stub inside the lantern and returned the flint and steel.
"'Tis a well-shielded little bit of light, Goodman,' Feldegast told him. "'And it be darker than the inside of your boots in this place. Trust me in this, for I can keep it so well concealed that not the tiniest bit of a glow will escape me control.'
"'Isn't that what they call a burglar's lantern?' Silk asked curiously.
"'Well, now,' Feldegast's whisper sounded slightly injured. "'I don't know what I'd call it that exactly. 'Tis a word that has an unsavory ring to it.'
"'Melgareth,' Silk chuckled softly. "'I think your friend here has a more checkered past than we have been led to believe. "'I wondered why I liked him so much.'
Feldegast had closed down the tin sides of his little lantern, allowing only a single small spot of light feebly illuminating the floor directly in front of his feet.
"'Come along, then. The sallyport goes back away under the wall here, and then we come to the grate that used to close it off. Then it makes a turn to the right, and a little further on another to the left, and then it comes out in the courtyard of the house.'
"'Why so many twists and turns?' Geryon asked.
"'Torek was a crooked sort, don't you know? I think he hated straight lines almost as much as he hated the sun.'
They followed the faint spot of light the lantern cast. Leaves had blown in through the entrance over the centuries to lie in a thick, damp mat on the floor, effectively muffling the sounds of their horses' hooves. The grate that barred the passageway was a massively constructed criss-cross of rusty iron. Feldegast fumbled for a moment, with the huge latch, then swung it clear.
"'And now, me large friend,' he said to Toth, "'we'll be having a need of your great strength here. The gate is cruel heavy, let me warn ye, and the hinges be so choked with rust that they will not likely yield easily.'
He paused a moment.
"'Ah, and that reminds me. Where have me brains gone? We'll be needing something to mask the dreadful squeaking when you swing that grate open.'
He looked back at the others.
"'Take a firm grip on the reins of your horses, for this is likely to give him a bit of a turn.'
Toth placed his huge hands on the heavy grate, then looked at the juggler.
"'Go!'
Feldegast said sharply. Then he lifted his face and bayed, his voice almost perfectly imitating the sound of one of the great hounds prowling outside,
even as the giant slowly swung the grate open on shrieking hinges. Kutchin snorted and shied back from the dreadful howl, but Geryon held his reins tightly.
"Oh, that was clever," Silk said in quiet admiration. "Oh, I have me moments from time to time," Feldegast admitted. "With all the dogs outside raising their awful caterwauling, 'tis certain that one more little yelp won't attract no attention. But the squealing of them hinges could have been an altogether different matter."
He led them on through the now open grate and along the dark passageway to a sharp right-hand turn. Somewhat farther along, the passage bent again to the left. Before he rounded that corner, the juggler closed down his lantern entirely, plunging them into total darkness.
"We be approaching the main court now," he whispered back to them. "'Tis the time for silence and caution, for if there be others in the house, they'll be paying a certain amount of attention to be sure that no one creeps up on them. There'll be a handrail along the wall there, and I think it might be wise to tie the horses here. Their hooves would make a fearful clatter on the stones of the court, and will not want to be riding them up and down the corridors of this accursed place."
Silently, they tied the reins of their mounts to the rusty iron railing, and then crept on quiet feet to the turn in the passageway. There was a lessening of the darkness beyond the turn, not light, certainly, but a perceptible moderation of the oppressive gloom. And then they reached the inside entrance to the sallyport, and looked out across the broad courtyard toward the looming black house beyond. There was no discernible grace to the construction of the house. It rose in blocky ugliness, almost as if the builders had possessed no understanding of the meaning of the word beauty, but had striven instead for a massive kind of arrogance to reflect the towering pride of its owner.
"Well," Belgarath whispered grimly, "that's Asheba."
Geryon looked at the dark house before him, half in apprehension, half with a kind of dreadful eagerness. Something caught his eye then, and he thrust his head out to look along the front of the house across the court. At the far end, in a window on the lower floor, a dim light was glowing, looking for all the world like a watchful eye. Chapter 17.
"Now what?" Silk breathed, looking at the dimly lighted window.
"We've got to cross that courtyard to get to the house, but we can't be sure if there's somebody watching from that window or not."
"You've been out of the academy for too long, Keldar,"
Velvet murmured.
"You have forgotten your lessons. If stealth is impossible, then you try boldness."
"You're suggesting that we just walk up to the door and knock?"
"Well, I had not planned to knock exactly."
"What have you got in mind, Lysel?"
Volgara asked quietly.
"If there are people in the house, they are probably Grolems, right?"
"It's more than likely," Belgarath said. "Most other people avoid this place."
"Grolems pay little attention to other Grolems, I have noticed."
"You're forgetting. We don't have any Grolem robes with us," Silk pointed out.
"It's very dark in that courtyard, Keldar, and in shadows that deep. Any dark color would appear black, would it not?"
"I suppose so," he admitted.
"And we still have those green silk slaver's robes in our packs, don't we?"
He squinted at her in the darkness, and then looked at Belgarath.
"It goes against all my instincts. But it might just work at that."
"One way or another, we have got to get into the house. We have to find out who is in there and why, before we can decide anything." "Would Sandra must have Grorums with her?"
Zinedra asked.
"If she is alone in that house, as she sees a line of Grolems walking across the courtyard, wouldn't that frighten her into running away with my baby?"
Belgarath shook his head.
"Even if she does run, we are close enough to catch her, particularly since the orb can follow her, no matter how much she twists and dodges. Besides, if she is here, she's probably got some of her own Grolems with her. It's not really so far from here to Darsheva that she could not have summoned them."
"What about him?"
Durnick whispered the question and pointed at Feldegast.
He hasn't got a slaver's robe.
We will improvise something,
Velvet murmured. She smiled at the juggler.
I've got a nice dark blue dressing gown that should set off his eyes marvelously. We can add a kerchief to resemble a hood, and we can slip him by, if he stays in the middle of the group.
"'Twould be beneath my dignity, he objected.
Would you prefer to stay behind and watch the horses?
She asked pleasantly.
"'Tis a hard woman you are, my lady, he complained.
Sometimes, yes.
Let's do it, Belgarath decided. I have got to get inside that house.
It took only a few moments to retrace their steps to the place where the horses were tied, and to pull the neatly folded slaver's robes from their packs by the dim light of Veldegast's lantern.
Oh, isn't this ridiculous now?
The juggler grumbled indignantly, pointing down at the blue satin gown Velvet had draped about him.
I think it looks just darling,
Tenedra said.
If there are people in there, aren't they likely to be patrolling the corridors?
Durnick asked.
Only on the main floor, Goodman, Veldegast replied. The upper stories of the house be almost totally uninhabitable, on account of all the broken windows and the weather blowing around the corridors, for all the world like they was part of the great outdoors. There be a grand staircase just opposite the main door, and with just a bit of luck, we can nip up the stairs and be out of sight with no one the wiser. Once we're up there, we're not likely to encounter a living soul, unless you be counting the bats and mice and an occasional adventuresome rat.
You absolutely had to say that, didn't you?
Tenedra said caustically.
Oh, my poor little darling, he grinned at her. But quiet your fears. I'll be beside you, and I've yet to meet a bat, a mouse, or a rat. I couldn't best in a fair fight.
It makes sense, Belgarath. If we all go trooping through the lower halls, sooner or later someone is bound to notice us. Once we're upstairs and out of sight, though, I'll be able to reconnoiter and find out exactly what we are up against.
All right, the old man agreed.
But the first thing is to get inside.
Oh, let's be off, then,
Veldegast said, swirling his dressing gown about him with a flourish.
Hide that light, Belgarath told him.
They filed out through the entrance to the sallyport and marched into the shadowy courtyard, moving in the measured, swaying pace Grolem priests assumed on ceremonial occasions. The lighted window at the end of the house seemed somehow like a burning eye that followed their every move. The courtyard was really not all that large, but it seemed to Geryon that crossing it took hours. Eventually, however, they reached the main door. It was large, black, and nail-studded, like the door of every Grolem temple Geryon had ever seen. The steel mask mounted over it, however, was no longer polished. In the faint light coming from the window at the other end of the house, Geryon could see that over the centuries it had rusted, making the coldly beautiful face look scabrous and diseased. What made it look perhaps even more hideous were the twin gobbets of lumpy, semi-liquid rust running from the eye sockets and down the cheeks. Geryon remembered with a shudder the fiery tears that had run down the stricken god's face before he had fallen. They mounted the three steps to that bleak door, and Toth slowly pushed it open. The corridor inside was dimly illuminated by a single flickering torch at the far end. Opposite the door, as Veldegast had told them, was a broad staircase reaching up into the darkness. The treads were littered with fallen stone, and cobwebs hung in long festoons from a ceiling lost in shadow. Still moving at that stately Grolem pace, Belgarath led them across the corridor and started up the stairs. Geryon followed close behind him with a measured tread, though every nerve screamed at him to run. They had gone perhaps halfway up the staircase when they heard a clinking sound behind them, and there was a sudden light at the foot of the stairs.
"What are you doing?"
a rough voice demanded.
"Who are you?"
Geryon's heart sank, and he turned. The man at the foot of the stairs wore a long, coat-like shirt of mail. He was helmeted and had a shield strapped to his left arm. With his right he held aloft a sputtering torch.
"Come back down here," the mailed man commanded them.
The giant Toth turned obediently, his hood pulled far over his face with his arms crossed so that his hands were inside his sleeves. With an air of meekness, he started down the stairs again.
"I mean all of you,"
the temple guardsman insisted.
"I order you in the name of the god of Angarak."
As Toth reached the foot of the stairs, the guardsman's eyes widened as he realized that the robe the huge man wore was not Grolem black.
"What is this? You are not Kendam, you are—"
He broke off suddenly, as one of Toth's huge hands seized him by the throat and lifted him off of the floor. He dropped his torch, kicking and struggling. Then, almost casually, Toth removed his helmet with his other hand and banged his head several times against the stone wall of the corridor. With a shudder, the mail-coated man went limp. Toth draped the unconscious form across his shoulder and started back up the stairs. Silk bounded back down to the corridor, picked up the steel helmet and extinguished torch, and he came back up again.
"Always clean up the evidence," he murmured to Toth. "No crime is complete until you have tidied up."
Toth grinned at him. As they neared the top of the stairs, they found the treads covered with leaves that had blown in from the outside, and the cobwebs hung in tatters like rotted curtains, swaying in the wind that came moaning in from the outside through the shattered windows. The hall at the top of the stairs was littered. Dry leaves lay in ankle-deep windrows on the floor, skittering before the wind. A large, empty casement at the end of the corridor behind them was half-covered with thick ivy that shook and rustled in the chill night wind blowing down off of the slopes of the mountains. Doors had partially rotted away and hung in chunks from their hinges. The rooms beyond those doors were choked with leaves and dust, and the furniture and bedding had long since surrendered every scrap of cloth or padding to thousands of generations of industrious mice in search of nesting materials. Toth carried his unconscious captive into one of those rooms, bound him hand and foot, then gagged him to muffle any outcry should he awaken before dawn.
"That light was at the other end of the house, wasn't it?" Geryon asked. "What's at that end?"
"'Twas the living quarters of Torak himself," Feldegast replied, adjusting his little lantern so that it emitted a faint beam of light. "His throne room be there, and his private chapel. I could even show you to his personal bedroom, and you could bounce up and down on his great bed, or what's left of it, just for fun, if you're of a mind."
"I think I could live without doing that."
Velgareth had been tugging at one earlobe.
"Have you been here lately?"
he asked the juggler.
"Perhaps 6 months ago."
"Was anybody here?"
Sinedra demanded.
"I'm afraid not, me darling. 'Twas as empty as a tomb."
"That was before Zandramos got here, Sinedra,"
Polgara reminded her gently.
"Why do you ask, Belgareth?"
"I have not been here since just after Vomimbre," Belgareth said, as they continued down the littered hall. "The house was fairly sound then, but Angaraks are not really notorious for their permanence of their construction. How is the mortar holding out?"
"'Tis as crumbly as your old bread,"
Belgareth nodded.
"I thought it might be. Now, what we are after here is information, not open warfare in the corridors."
"Unless the one who's here happens to be Zandramas," Geryon corrected. "If she's still here with my son, I'll start a war that's going to make Vomimbre look like a county fair."
"And I will clean up anything he misses,"
Sinedra added fiercely.
"Can't you control them?" Belgareth asked his daughter.
"Not under the circumstances, no. I might even decide to join in myself."
"I thought that we'd more or less erased the Elorn side of your nature, Paul."
"That's not the side that was just talking, father."
"My point," Belgareth said. "At least the point I was trying to make before everybody started flexing his or her muscles is that it is altogether possible that we will be able to hear and maybe even see what is going on in the main part of the house from up here. If the mortar is as rotten as Feldegast says it is,
It should not be too hard to find or make some little crevices in the floor of one of these rooms and find out what we need to know. If Zandramos is here, that's one thing, and we will deal with her in whatever way seems appropriate. But if the only people down there are some of Ervon's Kandem and guardsmen or a roving band of Mangus Gerandi's fanatics, we will pick up Zandramos's trail and go on about our business without announcing our presence. Well, that sounds reasonable, Durnick agreed. It doesn't make much sense to get involved in unnecessary fights. I am glad that someone in this belligerent little group has common sense, the old man said. Of course, if it is Zandramos down there, the smith added, I'll have to take steps myself. You too, Belgarath groaned. Well, naturally. After all, Belgarath, right is right.
They moved on along the leaf-strewn corridor where the cobwebs hung from the ceiling in tatters, and where there were skittering sounds in the corners. As they passed a large double door so thick that it was still intact, Belgarath seemed to remember something.
I want to look in here, he muttered.
As he opened those doors, the sword strapped across Geryon's back gave a violent tug that very nearly jerked him off of his feet.
Grandfather,
he gasped. He reached back, instructing the orb to restrain itself, and drew the great blade. The point dipped to the floor, and then he was very nearly dragged into the room.
She's been here,
he exulted.
What?
Durnick asked.
Zandramas. She has been in this room with Geryon.
Feldegast opened the front of his lantern wider to throw more light into the room. It was a library, large and vaulted, with shelves reaching from floor to the ceiling, and filled with dusty, moldering books and scrolls.
So, that was what she was looking for.
For what? Silk asked.
A book. A prophecy, most likely.
His face grew grim.
She is following the same trail that I am, and this would probably be just about the only place where she could find an uncorrupted copy of the Ashabine Oracles.
Oh!
Sinedra's little cry was stricken. She pointed a trembling hand at the dust-covered floor. There were footprints there. Some of them had obviously been made by a woman's shoes, but there were others as well, quite tiny.
My baby! He's been here,
Sinedra said, in a voice near tears. And then she gave a little wail and began to weep.
He's walking,
she sobbed.
And I'll never be able to see his first steps.
Polgara moved to her and took her into a comforting embrace. Geryon's eyes also filled with tears, and his grip on the hilt of his sword grew so tight that his knuckles turned white. He felt an almost overpowering need to smash things. Belgarath was swearing under his breath.
What's the matter? Silk asked him. That was the main reason I had to come here, the old man grated. I need a clean copy of the Ashabine Oracles, and Zandramos has beaten me to it. Maybe there's another. Not a chance. She's been running ahead of me, burning books at every turn. If there was more than one copy here, she would have made sure that I could not get my hands on it. That's why she stayed here so long, ransacking this place to make sure that she had the only copy.
He started to swear again.
Is this in any way significant?
Arion said, going to a table that, unlike the others in the room, had been dusted and even polished. In the precise center of that table lay a book bound in black leather and flanked on each side by a candlestick. Ariand picked it up, and as he did so, a neatly folded sheet of parchment fell out from between its leaves. The young man bent, picked it up, and glanced at it.
What's that? Belgarath demanded.
It's a note,
Ariand replied.
It's for you.
He handed the parchment and the book to the old man. Belgarath read the note. His face went suddenly pale, then beet red. He ground his teeth together with the veins swelling in his face and neck. Geryon felt the sudden building up of the old sorcerer's will.
Father, Polgara snapped.
No. Remember that we are not here alone.
He controlled himself with a tremendous effort,
Then he crumpled the parchment into a ball and hurled it at the floor so hard that it bounced high into the air and rolled across the room. He swung back the hand holding the book as if he were about to send it after the ball of parchment, but then seemed to think better of it. He opened the book at random, turned a few pages, and then began to swear so furiously. He shoved the book at Geryon.
"Here," he said. "Hold on to this."
Then he began to pace up and down. His face was as black as a thundercloud, and he muttered curses and waved his hands in the air. Geryon opened the book, tilting it to catch the light. He saw at once the reason for Belgarath's anger. Whole passages had been neatly excised, not merely blotted out, but cut entirely from the page with a razor or very sharp knife. Geryon also started to swear. Silk curiously went over, picked up the parchment, and looked at it. He swallowed hard and looked apprehensively at the swearing Belgarath. "Oh, my," he said.
"What is it?"
Geryon asked.
"I think we had all better stay out of your grandfather's way for a while," the rat-faced man replied. "It might take him a little bit to get a hold of himself."
"Just read it, Silk," Belgarath said. "Don't editorialize." Silk looked again at Belgarath, who was now at the far end of the room, pounding on the stone wall with his fist.
"Belgarath, I have beaten the old man. Now I go to the place which is no more, for the final confrontation. Follow me if thou canst. Perhaps this book will help thee."
"Is it signed?"
Velvet asked him.
"Zandramas. Who else?" "That is a truly offensive letter," Zadi murmured.
He looked at Belgarath, who continued to pound his fist on the wall in impotent fury.
"I am surprised that he is taking it so well, all things considered."
"It answers a lot of questions, though,"
Velvet said thoughtfully.
"Such as what?" Silk wanted to know.
"We were wondering if Zandramas was still here. Quite obviously she is not. Not even an idiot would leave that kind of message for Belgarath and then stay around where he could get his hands on her."
"That is true," he agreed. "There's no real point in our staying here, then, is there?
The orb has picked up the trail again, so why don't we just slip out of this house and go after Zandramas?"
"Without finding out who's here," Feldegast objected. "My curiosity's been aroused, and I'd hate to go off with it unsatisfied."
He glanced across the room at the fuming Belgarath.
"Besides, it's going to be a little while before our ancient friend there regains his composure. I think I'll go along to the far end of the hall and see if I can find a place where I can look down into the lower part of the house, just to answer some burning questions which have been nagging at me."
He went to the table and lighted one of the candles from his little lantern.
"Would you be wanting to come along with me, Prince Keldar?" he invited.
Silk shrugged.
"Why not?"
"I'll go too,"
Geryon said. He handed the book to Polgara, then pointedly looked at the raging Belgarath.
"Is he going to get over that eventually?" "I'll talk with him, dear. Don't be too long."
He nodded, and then he, Silk, and the juggler quietly left the library. There was a room at the far end of the hall. It was not particularly large, and there were shelves along the walls. Geryon surmised that it had at one time been a storeroom or a linen closet. Feldegast squinted appraisingly at the leaf-strewn floor and then closed his lantern. The leaves had piled deep in the corners and along the walls, but in the sudden darkness a faint glow shone up through them, and there came the murmur of voices from below.
"Me vile-tempered old friend seems to have been right," Feldegast whispered. "'Twould appear that the mortar has quite crumbled away along that wall. 'Twill be but a simple matter to brush the leaves out of the way and give ourselves some convenient spy-holes. Let's be having a look and find out who's taken up residence in the house of Torak."
Geryon suddenly had that strange sense of re-experiencing something that had happened a long time ago. It had been in King Unheg's palace at Val-Alorn, and he had followed the man in the green cloak through the deserted upper halls until they had come to a place where crumbling mortar had permitted the sound of voices to come up from below. Then he remembered something else. When they had been at Tol Hunnath, Had not Belgorath said that most of the things that had happened while they were pursuing Zadar and the orb were likely to happen again, since everything was leading up to another meeting between the Child of Light and the Child of Dark? He tried to shake off the feeling, but without much success. They removed the leaves from the crack running along the far wall of the storeroom, carefully trying to avoid sifting any of them down into the room below. Then, each of them selected a vantage point from which to watch and listen. The room into which they peered was very large. Ragged drapes hung at the windows, and the corners were thick with cobwebs. Smoky torches hung in iron rings along the walls, and the floor was thick with dust and the litter of ages. The room was filled with black-robed grolems, a sprinkling of roughly clad Kerans, and a large number of gleaming temple guardsmen. Near the front, drawn up like a platoon of soldiers, a group of the huge black hounds of Torak sat on their haunches expectantly. In front of the hounds stood a black altar, showing signs of recent use, flanked on either side by a glowing brazier. Against the wall on a high dais was a golden throne, backed by thick, tattered black drapes, and by a huge replica of the face of Torak.
"'Twas burnt-faced throne room, don't you know?" Feldegast whispered.
"Those are Kandam, aren't they?"
Garion whispered back.
"The very same. Both human and beast, along with their mail-shirted bully boys. I'm a bit surprised that Ervon has not chosen to occupy the place with his dogs, though the best use for Ashabah has probably always been as a kennel."
It was obvious that the men in the throne room were expecting something by the nervous way they kept looking at the throne. Then a great gong sounded from below, shimmering in the smoky air.
"On your knees,"
a huge voice commanded the throng in the large room.
"Pay obeisance and homage to the new god of Angarak."
"What?" Silk exclaimed in a choked whisper. "Watch and be still,"
Feldegast snapped. From below there came a great roll of drums, followed by a brazen fanfare. The rotten drapes near the golden throne parted, and a double file of robed grolems entered, chanting fervently. Even as the assembled Kandam and guardsmen fell to their knees, and the hounds and the Kerans groveled and whined. The booming of the drums continued, and then a figure garbed in a cloth of gold and wearing a crown strode imperiously out from between the drapes. A glowing nimbus surrounded the figure, though Garion could clearly sense that the will that maintained the glow emanated from the gold-clad man himself. Then the figure lifted its head in a move of overweening arrogance. The man's face was splotched, some patches showing the color of healthy skin, others a hideous dead white. What chilled Garion's blood the most, however, was the fact that the man's eyes were totally mad.
"Ervon," Feldegast said, with a sudden intake of breath. "You piebald son of a mangy dog!"
All trace of his lilting accent had disappeared. Directly behind the patch-faced madman came a shadowy figure, cowled so deeply that its face was completely obscured. The black that covered it was not that of a simple grolem robe, but seemed to grow out of the figure itself. And Garion felt a cold dread, as a kind of absolute evil permeated the air about that black shape. Ervon mounted the dais and seated himself on the throne, his insane eyes bulging, and his face frozen in that expression of imperious pride. The shadow-covered figure took its place behind his left shoulder, and bent forward toward his ear, whispering and whispering. The Kandam, guardsmen, and Kerans in the throne room continued to grovel, fawning and whining, even as did the hounds, while the last disciple of Torak preened himself in the glow of their adulation. A dozen or so of the black-robed Kandam crept forward on their knees, bearing gilded chests and reverently placing them on the altar before the dais. When they opened the chests, Garion saw that they were all filled to the brim with red Angarak gold and jewels.
"These offerings are pleasing to my eyes," the enthroned disciple declared in his shrill voice, Let others come forth to make also their offerings unto the new god of Angarak.
There was a certain amount of consternation among the Kandam, and a few hasty consultations. The next group of offerings were in plain wooden boxes. When they were opened, they revealed only pebbles and twigs. Each of the Kandam, who bore those boxes to the altar, surreptitiously removed one of the gilded chests after depositing his burden on the black stone. Irvan gloated over the chests and boxes, apparently unable to distinguish between gold and gravel, as the line continued to move toward the altar. Each priest laying one offering on the altar and removing another before returning to the end of the line.
"I am well pleased with thee, my priest," Irvan said, that shrill voice of his continuing when the charade had been played out. "Truly ye have brought before me the wealth of nations."
As the Kandam, Kerans, and guardsmen rose to their feet, the shadowy figure at Irvan's shoulder continued to whisper.
"And now will I receive Lord Menga," the madman announced, "most favored of all who serve me, for he has delivered unto me this familiar spirit, who revealed my high divinity unto me."
He indicated the shadow behind him.
"Summon the Lord Menga, that he may pay homage to the god Irvan, and be graciously received by the new god of Angarak."
The voice that boomed that command was as hollow as a voice issuing from a tomb. From the door at the back of the hall came another fanfare of trumpets, and another hollow voice responded,
"All hail Irvan, new god of Angarak! Lord Menga approacheth to make his obeisance, and to seek counsel with the living god."
Again there came the booming of drums, and a man robed in Grolem black paced down the broad aisle toward the altar and the dais. As he reached the altar, he genuflected to the madman seated on Torak's throne.
"Look now upon the awesome face of Lord Menga, most favored servant of the god Irvan, and soon to become first disciple,"
the hollow voice boomed. The figure before the altar turned and pushed back his hood to reveal his face to the throng. Geryon stared, suppressing a gasp of surprise. The man standing before the altar was Herakan. Chapter 18.
"Baelor," Silk swore under his breath.
"All bow down to the first disciple of your god," Irvan declaimed in his shrill voice. "It is my command that ye honor him."
There was a murmur of amazement among the assembled Kandam, and Geryon, peering down from above, thought he could detect a certain reluctance on the faces of some of them.
"Bow to him!"
Irvan shrieked, starting to his feet.
"He is my disciple!"
The Kandam looked first at the frothing madman on the dais, and then at the cruel face of Herakan. Fearfully, they sank to their knees.
"I am pleased to see such willing obedience to the commands of our god," Herakan observed sardonically. "I shall remember it, always."
There was a scarcely veiled threat in his voice.
"Know ye all that my disciple speaks with my voice," Irvan announced, resuming his seat upon the throne. "His words are my words, and ye will obey him even as ye obey me."
"Hear the words of our god," Herakan intoned in that same sardonic voice. "For mighty is the god of Angarak, and swift to anger, should any fail to heed him. Know further that I, Menga, am now the sword of Irvan, as well as his voice, and that the chastisement of the disobedient is in my hands."
The threat was no longer veiled, and Herakan swept his eyes slowly across the faces of the assembled priests, as if challenging each of them to protest his elevation.
"Hail, Menga, disciple of the living god,"
one of the mailed guardsmen shouted.
"Hail Minga!"
the other guardsmen responded, smashing their fists against their shields in salute.
"Hail Minga!" the Kerens shrieked.
"Hail Minga!" the kneeling Kandam said at last, cowed finally into submission.
And then the great hounds crept forward on their bellies to fawn about Herrikan's feet and to lick his hands.
"It is well,"
the enthroned madman declared in his shrill voice.
"Know that the god of Ingrek is pleased with ye."
Then another figure appeared in the throne room, coming through the same rotted drapes which had admitted Irvan. The figure was slender and dressed in a robe of clinging black satin. Its head was partially covered by a black hood, and it was carrying something concealed beneath its robe. When it reached the altar, it tipped back its head in a derisive laugh, revealing a face with at once an unearthly beauty and an unearthly cruelty, all cast in marble white.
"You poor fools,"
the figure rasped in a harsh voice.
"Think you to raise a new god over Angorak without my permission? I have not summoned thee, Zandramas,"
Irvan shouted at her.
"I feel no constraint to heed thy summons, Irvan,"
she replied in a voice filled with contempt.
"Nor its lack. I am not thy creature, as are these dogs. I serve the god of Angorak, and whose coming shalt thou be cast down." "I am the god of Angorak,"
he shrieked. Herrikan had begun to come around the altar toward her.
"And wilt thou pit thy puny will against the will of the child of Dark, Herrikan?"
she asked coolly.
"Thou mayest change thy name, but thy power is no greater."
Her voice was like ice. Herrikan stopped in his tracks, his eyes suddenly wary. She turned back to Irvan.
"I am dismayed that I was not notified of thy deification, Irvan,"
she continued.
"For should I have known, I would have come before thee to pay thee homage and seek thy blessing."
Then her lip curled in a sneer that distorted her face.
"Thou?"
she said.
"Thou, a god? Thou mayst sit upon the throne of Torak for all eternity, whilst this shabby ruin crumbles about thee, and thou wilt never become a god. Thou mayst fondle dross and call it gold, and thou wilt never become a god. Thou mayst bask in the canine adulation of thy cringing dogs, who even now befoul thy throne room with their droppings, and thou wilt never become a god. Thou mayest hearken greedily to the words of thy tame demon Nehaz, who even now whispers the counsels of madness in thine ear, and thou wilt never become a god." "I am a god!"
Irvan shrieked, starting to his feet again.
"So, it may be even as thou sayest, Irvan,"
she almost purred.
"But if thou art a god, I must tell thee to enjoy thy godhood, whilst thou may. For even as maimed Torak, thou art doomed."
"Who hath the might to slay a god?"
he foamed at her. Her laugh was dreadful.
"Who hath the might? Even he who reft Torak of his life. Prepare thyself to receive the mortal thrust of the burning sword of Iron Grip, the same which spilled out the life of thy master, for thus I summon the God-Slayer."
And then she reached forward and placed the cloth-wrapped bundle, which had been concealed beneath her robe, on the black altar. She raised her face and looked directly at the crack through which Geryon was staring in frozen disbelief.
"Behold thy son, Bel Geryon,"
she called up to him,
"and hear his crying."
She turned back the cloth to reveal the infant Geryon,
The baby's face was contorted with fear, and he began to wail, a hopeless, lost sound. All thought vanished from Geryon's mind. The wailing was the sound he had been hearing over and over again since he had left Malzeth. It was not the wail of that doomed child in those plague-stricken streets that had haunted his dreams. It was the voice of his own son. Powerless to resist that wailing call, he leaped to his feet. It was as if there were suddenly sheets of flame before his eyes, flames that erased everything from his mind but the desperate need to go to the child wailing on the altar below. He realized dimly that he was running through the shadowy, leaf-strewn halls, roaring insanely, even as he ripped Iron Grip's sword from its sheath. The moldering doors of long empty rooms flashed by as he ran full tilt along the deserted corridor. Dimly, behind him, he heard Silk's startled cry. "Geryon, no!" Heedless, his brain afire, he ran on with the great sword of Riva blazing in his hand before him as he went. Even years later, he did not remember the stairs. Vaguely, he remembered emerging in the lower hall, raging. There were temple guardsmen and Karans there, flinching before him and trying feebly to face him. But he seized the hilt of his sword in both hands and moved through them like a man reaping grain. They fell in showers of blood as he sheared his way through their ranks. The great door to the dead god's throne room was closed and bolted, but Geryon did not even resort to sorcery. He simply destroyed the door, and those who were trying desperately to hold it closed, with his burning sword. The fire of madness filled his eyes as he burst into the throne room. He roared at the terrified men there, who gaped at the dreadful form of the God-Slayer, advancing upon them enclosed in a nimbus of blue light. His lips were peeled back from his teeth in a snarl, and his terrible sword, all ablaze, flickered back and forth before him like the shears of fate. A Grolem jumped in front of him with one arm upraised, as Geryon gathered his will with an inrushing sound he scarcely heard. Geryon did not stop. The other Grolems in the throne room recoiled in horror as the point of his flaming sword came sliding out from between the rash priest's shoulder blades. The mortally wounded Grolem stared at the sizzling blade sunk into his chest. He tried with shaking hands to clutch at the blade, but Geryon kicked him off the sword and continued his grim advance. A Karand with a skull-surmounted staff stood in his path, desperately muttering an incantation. His words cut off abruptly, however, as Geryon's sword passed through his throat.
"Behold the God-Slayer, Urvan,"
Sandramas exulted.
"Thy life is at an end, God of Angarak, for Belgarion hath come to spill it out, even as he spilled out the life of Torak."
Then she turned her back on the cringing madman.
"All hail the Child of Light,"
she announced. She smiled her cruel smile at him.
"Hail, Belgarion,"
she taunted him.
"Slay once again the god of Angarak, for that hath ever been thy task. I shall await thy coming in the place which is no more."
And then she took up the wailing babe in her arms, covered it with her cloak again, shimmered, and vanished. Geryon was suddenly filled with chagrin as he realized that he had been cruelly duped. Zandramas had not actually been here with his son, and all his overpowering rage had been directed at an empty projection. Worse than that, he had been manipulated by the haunting nightmare of the wailing child, which he now realized she had put into his mind to force him to respond to her summons. He faltered then, his blade lowering and its fire waning.
"Kill him," Harrigan shouted. "Kill the one who slew Thorak."
"Kill him,"
Urvan echoed in his insane shriek.
"Kill him and offer his heart up to me in sacrifice."
A half-dozen temple guardsmen began a cautious, clearly reluctant advance. Geryon raised his sword again. Its light flared anew, and the guardsmen jumped back. Harrigan sneered as he looked at the armored men.
"Behold the reward for cowardice," he snapped.
He extended one hand, muttered a single word,
and one of the guardsmen shrieked and fell writhing to the floor as his mail coat and helmet turned instantly white-hot, roasting him alive.
"Mull, obey me," Hurricane roared at them. "Kill him."
The terrified guardsmen attacked more fervently then, forcing Geryon back step by step. Then he heard the sound of running feet in the corridor outside. He glanced quickly over his shoulder and saw the others come bursting into the throne room.
"Have you lost your mind?" Belgareth demanded angrily.
"I'll explain later," Geryon told him, still half sick with frustration and disappointment. He returned his attention to the armored men before him and began swinging his great sword in wide sweeps, driving them back again. Belgareth faced the Khandim on one side of the central aisle, concentrated for an instant, then gestured shortly. Suddenly, a raging fire erupted from the stones of the floor all along the aisle. Something seemed to pass between the old man and Palgra. She nodded, and quite suddenly the other side of the aisle was also walled off by flame. Two of the guardsmen had fallen beneath Geryon's sword, but others, accompanied by wild-eyed Kerans, were rushing to the aid of their comrades. Though they flinched visibly from the flames on either side of the aisle, up which they were forced to attack.
"Combine your wills," Hurricane was shouting to the Khandim. "Smother the flames."
Even as he closed with the guardsmen and the Kerans, beating down their upraised swords and hacking at them with Iron Grip's blade, Geryon felt the rush and surge of combined will. Despite the efforts of Belgareth and Polgara, the fires on either side of the aisle flickered and grew low. One of the huge hounds came loping through the ranks of the guardsmen facing Geryon. Its eyes were ablaze, and its tooth-studded muzzle agape. It leaped directly at his face, snapping and growling horribly, but fell twitching and biting at the floor as he split its head with his sword. Then, Hurricane thrust his way through the guardsmen and Kerans to confront Geryon.
"And so we meet again, Belgareon,"
he snarled in an almost dog-like voice.
"Drop your sword, or I will slay your friends and your wife. I have 100 Khandim with me, and not even you are a match for so many."
And he began to draw in his will. Then, to Geryon's amazement, Velvet ran forward past him, her arms stretched toward the dread Grolem.
"Please," she wailed. "Please don't kill me."
And she threw herself at Hurricane's feet, clutching at his black robe imploringly as she cringed and groveled before him. Thrown off balance by this sudden and unexpected display of submissiveness, Hurricane let his will dissipate and he backed away, trying to shake her hand from his robe and kicking at her to free himself. But she clung to him, weeping and begging for her life.
"Get her off me,"
he snapped at his men, turning his head slightly. And that briefest instant of inattention proved fatal. Velvet's hand moved so quickly that it seemed to blur in the air. She dipped swiftly into her bodice. When her hand emerged, she held a small, bright green snake.
"A present for you, Hurricane,"
she shouted triumphantly.
"A present for the leader of the bear cult from Hunter."
And she threw Zith full force into his face. He screamed once the first time Zith bit him, and his hands came up to claw her away from his face, but the scream ended with a horrid gurgle, and his hands convulsed helplessly in the air in front of him. Squealing and jerking, he reeled backward as the irritated little reptile struck again and again. He stiffened and arched back across the altar, his feet scuffing and scrabbling on the floor, his arms flopping uselessly. He banged his head on the black stone, his eyes bulging, and his swollen tongue protruding from his mouth. Then, a dark froth came from his lips. He jerked several more times, and his body slid limply off the altar.
"And that was for Bethra,"
Velvet said to the crumpled form of the man, lying dead on the floor before the altar. The Khandim and their cohorts again drew back in fear as they stared at the body of their fallen pack leader.
"They are few," Irvan shrieked at them. "We are many. Destroy them all. Your god commands it."
The Khandim gaped first at Hurricane's contorted body, then at the crowned madman on the throne, Then, at the terrible little snake who had coiled herself atop the altar, with her head raised threateningly, as she gave vent to a series of angry hisses.
"That is about enough of this," Belgareth snapped.
He let the last of the flames die, and began to refocus his will. Garion also straightened, pulling in his own will, even as he felt the frightened Candom start to focus their power for a final and dreadful confrontation.